All right, buckle up, everyone, because today we are diving headfirst into a case that is, well, let's just say it's going to stay with you.
Yeah, this one's a doozy.
It really is. State v. Crenshaw. Picture this. Newlyweds, they're on their honeymoon, and suddenly, bam, the husband becomes convinced his wife's cheating on him. And we're not talking just a little suspicion here. We're talking full-blown, unshakable belief.
And that belief unfortunately leads to an act of violence that is, well, it's almost impossible to comprehend.
24 stab wounds,
Yeah.
decapitation, and then a desperate, frantic attempt to get rid of the body. I mean, for anyone in law school, especially those just starting out, this case brings up so many legal questions. It's really a prime example of how messy things can get in the real world, you know, when you're dealing with criminal law and mental state and all those factors.
Oh, absolutely. State v. Crenshaw, it's a 1983 decision from the Washington Supreme Court, and trust me, it's way more than just a horrific story. This case, it cuts right to the core of what we mean by criminal responsibility, especially when you're dealing with, someone's mental state.
Right, exactly. And, you know, this case went through the ringer. You know, it started with a jury trial, conviction for first-degree murder. Then it got bumped up to the Court of Appeals. They upheld the conviction. And then finally, it landed in the laps of the highest court in Washington.
Yep. The Washington Supreme Court. This case, it's like a legal roller coaster.
It is. And that's why we're doing this deep dive. We want to break down two really huge issues that Crenshaw throws at us. And these are issues that any law student, any future lawyer, is going to have to wrap their heads around at some point. First, we're going to untangle this whole concept of wrong, right?
Yeah.
Like, what does wrong even mean when we're talking about the insanity defense? Is it about understanding the law, or is there like a deeper moral element to
Right. And then the second biggie, gruesome evidence.
it?
Think like crime scene photos and how those kinds of images, as tough as they are to look at, how they can be used or maybe not used in court.
Because we're talking about the photographs of the victim's body in this case. And I mean, that's heavy stuff. So let's jump into that first question. Insanity. So in Washington State, and a lot of other places too, they use this thing called the M. Knighton rule.
Oh, yeah, the M. Knighton rule. It's like the gold standard when it comes to insanity defenses. And this rule, it basically hinges on two key parts. You got to understand both of these pieces if you're going to, really grasp how this defense works.
Okay, so break it down for us. What are these two prongs of the M. Knighton rule?
All right, so the first part, it asks this question. At the time of the crime, was the defendant, were they suffering from some kind of mental disease or defect that made it impossible for them to understand what they were doing? Like, did they even grasp the nature and the quality of their actions? Were they so out of it that they didn't even realize what was happening?
Okay, so that's the first part. It's about like their grasp on reality at that moment.
Exactly. And then the second part, it tackles whether that same mental problem, that disease or defect, whether it made them unable to tell right from wrong. Like, could they make that distinction, even if they knew what they were physically doing?
Got it. And it's that second part, that whole right versus wrong thing, that really blew up in the Crenshaw case, didn't it? I mean, the heart of the legal battle was whether wrong means breaking the law, which is what the majority of the court went with, or if it's about violating some kind of moral code, which is what the dissenting judge was arguing.
You nailed it. The majority opinion, they were all about the history of the M. Knighton rule, going all the way back to when it was first established. Their argument was that back then, wrong was pretty much universally understood to mean breaking the law.
And here's where things get really interesting. Crenshaw's behavior right after the murder, it seemed to play a big role in how the court viewed his understanding of right and wrong. Like what he did after the crime, it almost contradicted his insanity defense.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The court, they made a big deal out of pointing out what Crenshaw did immediately after he killed his wife. He cleaned up the hotel room, he took off, he fled the state, he even tried to get random hitchhikers to help him ditch his wife's car, like he was trying to cover his
So
tracks.
the majority, they were saying that those actions, all that cleaning and running, that showed he knew what he did was illegal. Like he knew there would be consequences.
Exactly. Because if you're genuinely so mentally ill that you can't tell right from wrong, you wouldn't think to, cover up the crime. You wouldn't be worried about getting caught.
Right. Right. It's like, even if he was in some kind of delusional state when he actually committed the murder, his actions afterward suggested he knew he'd crossed a line.
Right. So it's this whole idea that even if your mindset during the crime was, you know, distorted or delusional, your actions afterward can actually undermine your claim of insanity. And then you have Crenshaw's defense, which was really tied into his religion. He was a Moscovite, and he basically claimed that his faith required him to kill his wife if she was unfaithful.
Yeah, so how did the court handle that argument? Because that brings up a whole other layer of complexity.
It does. So the court, they drew a very clear line, a distinction between a personal belief, even if it's deeply religious, and what they called a deific decree. That's like a direct, undeniable command from God. Basically, they said that Crenshaw's own interpretation of his religion, it didn't reach that level of like a divine order.
So they were saying you can't just say my religion made me do it and expect that to be a slam dunk insanity defense.
Right. They set a really high bar for those kinds of claims. You got to have more than just your own understanding of your faith. You need like a direct line to the Almighty saying, go do this.
And the court also pointed out, and I found this interesting, they said that in this case, the lines between what's morally wrong and what's legally wrong, those lines were basically the same.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, regardless of what someone personally believes about infidelity, taking another person's life, it's almost universally seen as both morally and legally wrong.
Okay, but this is where Justice Dory's dissenting opinion comes in, right? He really digs into that potential gap between what's morally wrong and what's against the law.
Absolutely. Justice Dory, he was like, hold on, the real question here is whether Crenshaw could tell right from wrong on a moral level. Like, did he understand that what he was doing was fundamentally wrong, even if he had some idea that it was also illegal? And he thought that was a question for the jury to decide, not something the court should just rule on.
So his argument was that if someone's mental illness makes it so they can't understand the morality of their actions, even if they know it's illegal, the insanity defense should still be on the table.
Right. And Justice Dory, he went even further. He pointed out that the majority opinion, it almost seemed to admit that there could be a difference between moral and legal wrong. Like, they were hinting that maybe their interpretation could change in the future. But then they denied Crenshaw the benefit of that distinction in his case. It's like they acknowledged the nuance but didn't apply it.
It's like they opened the door a crack but then slammed it shut. Okay, for all the law students listening, let's try to make these Ignite and Prongs a little more concrete. So can we walk through some examples to really highlight the difference between these two parts? You know, like when we say wrong, are we talking about breaking the law or are we talking about violating some deeper sense of right and wrong, even if there's no specific law against it?
Sure. Okay, imagine this. Someone is having a really intense hallucination. They're convinced they're swatting a dangerous bug, but they're actually hitting another person. That situation, that would probably fall under the first prong of Ignite, the inability to understand what they're actually doing. Their perception of reality is just like completely messed up. Now let's flip it. Imagine someone who knows they're killing another person and they know it's illegal, but they truly believe, like deep in their core, that what they're doing is morally right or even necessary. Maybe they have some kind of, you know, delusional belief system that justifies it. That's where the whole debate about the second prong, that moral versus legal wrong thing, that's where it gets really tricky.
Okay, that helps a lot. It's like in the first example, they're not even aware of what they're physically doing, but in the second example, they know what they're doing, but they think it's justified, even if it's based on a messed up belief system.
Exactly. And then, you know, you mentioned the harmless error doctrine earlier. It's like this legal concept that comes into play, even when there might be mistakes in the legal instructions given to the jury. And in the Crenshaw case, it ended up being a big factor in the final decision.
Right. So even if the jury was told that wrong means legally wrong, and even if that wasn't technically the perfect definition, the court still said the conviction should stand. So how did they justify that?
Basically, they said that even if they'd used a different definition of wrong, they didn't think the outcome of the trial would have changed. They looked at all the evidence and they concluded that Crenshaw hadn't really shown, like convincingly proven, that his mental state was so messed up that it prevented him from either understanding his actions or knowing right from wrong. And that's regardless of whether you define wrong in a legal or moral way.
So even if there were some technical issues with how the law was explained, the court felt like the jury's decision was ultimately the right one based on the evidence.
Yep, that's the gist of it. And for you future lawyers out there, this is huge. because it means that even if there are problems with legal instructions, if the evidence itself isn't strong enough to support a defense, it might not matter in the end. The outcome could still be the same.
That's a great point. It highlights how important it is to build a solid case with strong evidence, regardless of any potential procedural hiccups. Okay, let's move on to the second big issue in Crenshaw. The photographs, the really, really graphic photos of the victim's body. This case brings up a lot of questions about what kind of evidence should be shown to a jury, especially when it's so disturbing.
Oh, yeah. And this gets into the whole world of evidence law. Washington State has this thing called Evidence Rule 403. Basically, it's this balancing test that judges have to use. They have to weigh the probative value of the evidence, meaning how much does it actually help prove something important in the case, against the potential for unfair prejudice, which is like how much could it unfairly sway the jury's emotions.
So it's not just about whether the evidence is relevant. It's also about whether it's so emotionally charged that it could cloud the jury's judgment.
Exactly. And there are other factors courts look at, too, like if showing the evidence would just waste time or if it's basically repeating the same thing they've already heard. But the big ones are relevance and prejudice. And in the Crenshaw case, the court was dealing with photos of Karen Crenshaw's decapitated body. I mean, that's about as graphic as it gets.
Yeah. So what was the court's reasoning for allowing those photographs to be shown to the jury? I mean, it seems pretty obvious that they would have a strong emotional impact.
Right. So the court, they said that the photographs, as horrible as they were still relevant because they showed just how brutal the crime was. And they argued that this level of brutality, it actually helped to prove premeditation. Premeditation, that's like a key ingredient for a first-degree murder conviction.
Okay, so they're saying the violence itself became evidence of premeditation. And they needed to show the jury the extent of that violence to support that argument.
Exactly. Like, if the photos showed that the attack was particularly vicious, it could suggest that it wasn't just a spur-of-the-moment thing. It was planned.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
But the court also made it clear that just because something is shocking doesn't mean it's automatically admissible. They said that if there's already enough other evidence to prove a point, then there's no need to add in super graphic stuff just for shock value. But then they also had this famous quote. They said, "A bloody, brutal crime cannot be explained to a jury in a lily-white manner."
Yeah, that's a classic quote from this case. And it really captures the tough spot that judges are in. They have to make sure the jury understands the facts of the case, even the ugly ones. But they also have to be careful not to let emotions completely take over.
And for anyone who wants to be a trial lawyer, this case is a great lesson in how to argue for or against using certain types of evidence. Knowing how to handle emotionally charged evidence, it's a crucial skill.
Oh, absolutely. It's like a core part of being a good trial lawyer.
Okay, so as we wrap up our deep dive into State v. Crenshaw, what are the biggest takeaways? What should law students, especially those thinking about criminal law, what should they really remember from this case?
All right, so first off, this case is like a giant neon sign flashing, Washington loves the Imnotten rule. They're sticking with it for the insanity defense. And it clarifies that when they say wrong, they mean legally wrong. But, and this is important, the dissenting opinion shows that there's still a debate going on about whether morality should play a bigger role.
Right, it's not a settled issue, even if the court came down firmly on one side in this particular case.
Exactly. And the second big takeaway is that you can't just claim your religion made you commit a crime and expect to get away with it. The court was super clear about that. They drew a sharp line between a personal interpretation of faith and a direct command from God.
So claiming a religious justification, it's not impossible, but the bar is set really, really high.
Super high. And then finally, Crenshaw shows us how much power judges have when it comes to deciding what evidence is allowed in court, especially when you're talking about evidence that could really sway the jury's emotions. They have to balance the need to show the full picture with the risk of unfairly influencing the jury.
It's a delicate balancing act.
Yeah.
So for all the future lawyers listening, Crenshaw is packed with lessons.
Hmm.
You got to understand the legal definition of wrong when you're dealing with insanity defenses. You got to know that it's a tough defense to win, and you got to be prepared to grapple with how courts handle evidence that could be really disturbing.
You got it. This case, it's a crash course in some really complex legal issues.
It is. And on that note, here's something to think about as we finish up. Given all the twists and turns in Crenshaw, how should our legal system deal with that tension between holding people responsible for their actions and recognizing that mental illness can have a huge impact on their choices? especially in cases where what's morally wrong and what's legally wrong, where those two things might not line up perfectly. It's a question that's still being debated, and it has big implications for how we think about justice. So chew on that, and thanks for joining us for this deep dive.
It's been a pleasure.
See you next time.